Okay, welcome everyone to a new year, a new topic, and we're going to, as you all know, we're going to be looking at various aspects of medieval Jewish history over the course of this year. Medieval Jewish history is big, medieval Jewish history is incredibly rich, and the notion that we're going to sort of cover all of medieval Jewish history in a year of classes, it might sound like we have lots of time, but actually just mapping it out, there's like surgery happening everywhere. We've got to, you know, there's a lot of triage that has to happen in order to really make good judgments about what makes the most sense. So I'll kind of do my best. But before we actually make those decisions fully, and before we jump in, I wanted to ask you to just take a moment as we jump into a medieval Jewish history course, and you have your little index cards, and just a general question I'd love to hear everyone's thoughts on, and maybe a way of framing some of our learnings moving forward. What are the goals of learning Jewish history? Why is it important? Why do you think? So you can take about a minute and just put it on paper, and then let me know. Something about me that loves using a pen and paper in this era, it almost feels just a little bit rebellious. okay, anyone share? Do you want to get started?
I wrote understanding who certain key figures were, with in mind that when we're learning, especially, you know, if someone's name comes up, they should know who they're talking about, who they were. And I also wrote to see patterns maybe to enable different assessment of contemporary history.
Okay, so I'm hearing two thoughts. I'm hearing sort of offering context so that when we learn something, it sort of gives us a frame as to who that person was, which can enhance our learning, and then maybe it can give us insight into some of the contemporary challenges that we face in light of some of the prior patterns in history. Mm-hmm. Right? Love it.
I think I said something pretty similar, understanding where we are based on the past. And I guess also psychologically, I'm sort of interested in how patterns repeat from a communal level. And sometimes those patterns are good and sometimes they're not. So
sort of the notion that it can be sometimes harder to learn the lessons of history than we think because things become so deeply entrenched.
Right.
Interesting. I like that. Yeah.
Same.
The psychological piece also? Okay, good.
Pretty much where we come from, how we got there, a breakdown culturally of our people.
Good. Okay. Lisa?
I think it's the same. Understanding the past, it informs our present and it determines our future. So appreciating kind of the global context of looking at like the larger piece historically, so what was happening from a social, economical, political, religious, intellectual, psychological framework or perspective of the past, I think educates us and really will impact decisions that we need to make today about living today, understanding it in that larger context. So you asked about Jewish history specifically. So I guess there's two answers in there. One is kind of studying Jewish history and then understanding Jewish history with the lens of history, so that it's not just the Jewish people's history, but the Jewish people living within a world, within a context, and what, how that, the impact, how the arrows flowed in and out of.
Yeah, and that's going to be certainly a big piece of what we do is looking at those interactions on all the levels that you mentioned. So whether it's certainly psychological, but whether it's intellectual, what's the exchange, what's the give and take, what are the cultural implications of being embedded in a Muslim society, in a Christian society, and so on and so forth. Those can be major themes. I just want to add, all that of course resonates and certainly is true. For me, when I think about it also, I think it's certainly in this, I think Ruth, you had mentioned that to me sounded most like this. I think it's connected to something everyone said, which is just that sort of it deepens our Talmud Torah. In other words, to learn a source, to learn the Gemara, to learn anything that we study without sort of a sense of context, it's just much less rich. It just sort of cut off. It's kind of, you know, it's not sort of holistic in that sense. And sort of the wider a net that we cast and the richer understanding of everything that sort of goes around along with the halachic authority or the thinker or whomever, whatever it might have been, same with Tanakh, of course, you don't know the realia, it's just a much poorer sort of understanding and approach to the text. There's a better looking text on its own, but there's also really the contextual dimension, I think, is really, really valuable. And then one other thing that occurs to me, which connected to what everyone said, but I want to maybe take it a step further.
Can I close the door?
Please do. I would appreciate it. It's a word that we use. It's almost cliche, but I think it's a good word, which is the word roots. And when I think about the idea of going into our past, it's not just sort of an intellectual understanding or an ability to sort of make good judgments moving forward. It's certainly that. But I think it's also just sort of anchoring ourselves in a certain kind of narrative. And I think about this with my own children. I think about this with you know, our kids here, our students here in the school, but I think it's true for all of us on some levels. The notion of sort of anchoring ourselves within the roots and seeing our own personal narrative as part of sort of a larger Jewish narrative, universal narrative, and locating ourselves within that larger picture, I think really anchors us psychologically in a different sense here, but it really gives us a sense, a larger sense, a fuller sense, a richer sense, a deeper understanding of who it is that we are, and I think it allows us to, you know, it sort of is a way of kind of anchoring ourselves. There's a New York Times article last year in May. It basically described, it was a researcher's exploring the question, how can families ground themselves and remain connected to their kids and to their families? It's connected to some of the things. I think maybe we've spoken, I'm not sure if any. But it basically what the research found is that one of the most significant indicators for resilience in the face of all sorts of difficulties is having a family narrative. In other words, not just feeling connected, going and doing nice things with my family, but actually having some sort of story. This is where we come from. You know, the more that kids know about some of the challenges and the achievements of great-great-grandparents and, you know, my father, you know, like, in other words, all the different people in the family, what were their, you know, what did they go through? What sort of, what was our story as a people, as a family, as a group? Fascinatingly, that had all sorts of ramifications. So, for example, kids who had physical injuries, there's actually evidence showing that they heal better if they have a strong family narrative. I mean, there's no connection between those, there's no obvious connection between those at all. But this notion of resilience, this notion of an ability to cope with all sorts of different minor to large, more significant traumas, is actually one of the greatest indicators, is the sense of rootedness and sort of locating myself. Gives me a sense of self. I know that in my family, you know, we've had certain troubles, and yet we overcame. And that kind of anchoring has all sorts of different, very powerful, and it's perhaps perfect. Surprisingly, I mean, I think if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense, but it's not necessarily obvious that when we build a family, that when we build a community, that when we do whatever it is that we do, that we come together around not just shared values, but a narrative is something, I think, deeper, that kind of tells a story in which we locate ourselves. To me, that's what Jewish history is. So when I read it, I'm like, so how do I fit in? How do my children fit in? How do we all fit into this larger picture? I think it's a very, very powerful and impactful kind of experience.
Yeah, it's the Haggadah. It's Pesach. That's right. What we do. We go back and we say...
And we were one of them.
It's horrible.
It's not their story. It's our story.
But yeah. I think the research also, just to add, says that if it's just a positive narrative, that's yes. not as effective. Mm-hmm. Or if it's just a negative narrative, that it's about mm-hmm. struggle and overcoming. Struggle yeah. and, you know, that's the narrative that seems mm-hmm. to be the most powerful in terms of research.
Yeah, 100%.
You have to think about the families that are creating that narrative, the strength and resilience that they have to get kids through things. What is skew? So I didn't say that because of that.
Fair enough. Everyone kind of says their piece. And right? That's kind of the
repetition.
It's a self perpetuating. There's no question. Like a lot of things, like education, like everything else. Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. But yeah, and this same article, actually, there's a Dr. Duke who did a lot of this research. It says exactly that. They say there are three kinds of narratives. Exactly that. It's exactly what the article says. They are the purely positive, the purely negative. And the interesting thing is that purely positive is not nearly as effective as the overcame certain challenges. And then, so
do you remember Fran shared? She applied that to the repetition syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Which
would be
your safe story.
Your safe,
right. Yeah. Right. Yes.
I love that. That was the best thing.
Okay, not going too far. So what I want to do now is, this is really helpful, and I think these are just things to think about and to keep with us as we go through. And we try to connect between some of the things that we're learning and the meaning. So I'm going to play with some of our new toys.
Wow.
So this is the Apple TV. This is just a fancy word. That's just a. If you say the word Apple, it sounds really cool. So it's just a fancy. It's just a fancy projector. It is really nice. Screen. I just want to say I didn't request any of this. It just came to me. I just said that. No one. For the record. Hopefully it'll come up in 1 second. I just have to connect from here. 306, where are you? And hopefully it will come up. We will see. And what I'd like to do is come up. Is to take a look at a couple of maps that are going to help to frame. I hope it's... Can you see it? Yes. Is it good? Should we get...
great.
I hope you can see it well enough. I'm just going to get the lights. Okay. So hopefully post some of this stuff online as well. You can post sources and links and things like that so that everyone can... I'll get a sense of this, but let me just take you through. What I want to do is to use this map of medieval Jewish migration and a couple of other maps as well as a way of sort of framing our year. And all the intellectual currents and the cultural dimensions and our interactions both within the Jewish community internally and externally, whether it be Muslims or Christians, we can summarize them on the basis of this conversation. So essentially, here's going to be our story. Medieval Jewish history, if you'd ask someone what anyone, sort of a scholar, what is medieval Jewish history, right? You're going to get, nowadays, instead of getting one medieval Jewish history, you're going to get what we call medieval Jewish histories. They would answer, well, it depends what aspect you're looking at and how you want to break it down, economically, intellectually, and so on and so forth. So what we're going to be doing for our course is basically starting with the rise of Islam, which is in the 7th century, and going through the Spanish expulsion, so 1492. We could go longer, we could start earlier, we could start later, we could end earlier. It's a little bit artificial and depends on the kinds of questions that you're asking, but just that's what we're going to be looking at. And the first major community, this is going to be our first unit, is the period of the Gaonim. Is the period essentially from the 8th till, some say, or the 7th till the 10th century, but really runs longer into the 11th and even 12th centuries. And that's going to be centered in the Jewish community in Baghdad, along the Tigris, along the Euphrates, modern-day Iraq. You'll see it's not too far from the Arabian Peninsula. And so this is essentially a Jewish community that is a continuation, ultimately, of the exile. Ruth, can you just press on the...
The big one
on the bottom? Yeah. That's fine. That should be sure. Thank you. Is it coming up? Even when you pressed on the...
I did.
You got to press it.
Yeah, I did.
That is really weird and upsetting. One second. Is my computer gone? I don't know what happened.
Did you see anything here?
I don't know why it went blank. One second, I turned back the computer back on. I had to turn it off and on. Okay, so just to keep going and then we'll...
What happened?
It's really strange. So what we'll be starting with, as it hopefully comes back up, is looking at the...
Yeah, it's over here. Do you want me to play with that one?
Yeah, I don't know what's going on. I don't know what's going on with my computer. Okay, so hopefully it'll come back up. I don't think I've put it in. Oh, there it is. One second. Okay, I'm going to give it a minute. My Mac's been giving me some trouble the last day or two. So while it comes back up, so basically the first community we're looking at is the period, again, of the Gaonim, and centered around Baghdad, modern-day Iraq. And essentially what you have is... continuation of the Jewish exile to Babylonia. And we go all the way back. You think about the time of... Already the first temple, the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, we go to Babel, and we know that even at the time of the rebuilding of the second Beis HaMikdash, the overwhelming majority of the Jewish community did not return. Ezra, Nehemiah, and other leaders of Babel come back with the Jewish community, and they...
Excuse me, I'm sorry. He's here, and you can put the blind up. Is that going to be a problem? Do it.
No, we don't want to break. Yeah, just let them do it.
Okay.
It's all right.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Judy. So the
and
that community continued to exist in Babylonia, of course, with the writing of the Talmud Bavli, Babylonian Talmud, which is primarily completed around the year 500 of the Common Era, although then edited more slightly all the way pretty much until the time around, sometime around the Muslim conquest in the early 7th century, lighter edits still taking place to the Gemara. And we have the continuity of that Jewish community, and although you have the period of the Chatimat HaTalmud, the conclusion, the closing of the writing of the Gemara had already taken place, there's still a continuity of that Jewish community. The structure of the Jewish community is essentially split between a religious and secular leadership. The religious leadership is actually itself split into two, which doesn't mean necessarily it was negative, but there were two primary yeshivot, which went back and forth in terms of their respective level of prominence. One was called Sura, the other one called Pumbedita, fairly well-known Talmudical academies that go back to the time of the Gemara. Some of the outstanding Amoraim scholars of the Gemara studied in these yeshivot, were the heads of these respective yeshivot, served as the Rashi Yeshiva. And Sura and Pumbedita in that same general area are the two sort of loci of the rabbinic leadership of the Jewish community. There are Torah, there are many students who study there, and what became traditional even after the time of the Gemara, certainly something that continued very prominently, is that there was what was called the Yarchei Kala. And the Yarchei Kala was essentially that two times a year during Adar and during Elul, when it would work out with the farming season, we would have students would come and they would gather together with the Rosh of each respective institution of Surim Pumbedita, and for that month they would study all sorts of different halachot that had come to the attention, halachic questions, queries that had come to the attention of the rabbinic leader, and they would consider them together. And then together with the input of those students, at the end of this period of time, or at some point, the Gaon, the leader, the Gaon, right, becomes, is now the name at the, during the Gaonic period, that becomes the name. This Gaon literally means genius, but it becomes sort of a formal title, would start to produce these responsa, which were the outcome of the study together with his students over the course of that Yarchei Kalah. So that's the religious leadership. There's also, as we'll see, a Reish Galuta, an exilarch, who is empowered by the secular authorities to serve as the leadership or the political leadership, the not fully autonomous, but semi-autonomous Jewish government, essentially. And as you might imagine, there are all sorts of opportunities, but also challenges in terms of the relationship between the Jewish authorities and the secular authorities, between the Jewish political leadership and the Jewish rabbinic leadership, and so on and so forth. So we're going to be coming back to that. But that's basically, essentially, the period of the Gaonim, and we're going to be looking at that in greater depth. If you essentially, what happens is. That also I just mentioned as well. That's essentially, since it's after the rise of Islam that we're looking at, that's going to be something a culture in which we're embedded within Islam, and that's going to be really, really relevant and interesting. Essentially, we have as the continuation of the same community, but that had not been previously under Islamic dominion, and now laws. Okay, so essentially that's the period of the Gaonim, and for a wide variety of reasons, that community begins to peter out. There's some anti-Semitism we'll talk about a little bit, and essentially, if it ever comes up on the map, sir, I'm sorry. I know it's a good, can you do like another
sure.
Half an hour? Can you come back in like half an hour? Does that work? If you don't mind, that would be great. Thank you so much. Okay, I don't know why. I'll just have to reconnect it. I'm sorry, I'm having technological difficulties.
That's right.
Oh, it's clicked. It's really strange. Okay, so everyone huddle in, if you don't mind. Let's just do it on my computer.
Do you want to send it to the printer?
What?
Can you print it?
Yeah, I connected my printer. That's a good point. Thank you.
You have a printer.
I connected it. I'm saying I connected it to my new printer. All right. No, it's not coming up. Okay, well, let's just do this if you don't mind. So, in the meantime. Okay, so if you take a look, this community is centered over here. It's not. I pressed print. I don't know. It's going to be so
true. Maybe it's the Wi-Fi.
It's possible. My computer went blank. What?
The black screen.
You think?
No, seriously.
I'll do some later on today when I'll try to figure it out. Okay, the Jewish community begins to migrate. In particular, if you take a look at this line, which you can lean in, you can come around. Essentially, begins to migrate from Baghdad, and you'll see if you take a look at these lines through Egypt. You'll remember that the Rambam was early period of the Rishonim, was a little bit later, as we'll see. Is living in Egypt, and that's a prominent Jewish community, and they continue to move, and they come to places in the 10th century and the 11th century in particular, such as Tunisia and Morocco as well, northern African Jewish communities. This is all, of course, this is the Islamic community. These are known as the Sephardic communities, what we call nowadays, and the Jews essentially move to locations in North Africa around here. In Morocco is Rav Yitzchak Alfasi, the Rif, who's printed in the back of the Talmud. Amr the Outstanding, very early Rishonim. Rishonim is a medieval scholar, so the Gaonim are from around 700 to 1000, roughly. A little bit later, then the Rishonim are, again, a little bit of a rough estimate, but let's say for our purposes between 1000 and 1500, just to kind of simplify it. So the Rif is one of the outstanding scholars. Rabbeinu Hananel, also an outstanding early medieval Talmud commentary. He's living in Tunisia, so also living in North Africa. And these are also prominent Sephardic communities. And the Rif and Rabbeinu Hananel are two of the most influential early medieval Sephardic Talmudic commentators. And that's also going to be an Islamic existence. And then, eventually, moving into the medieval period, that community will migrate into Spain. And Spain becomes sort of the heart of the medieval Jewish community. The Rambam is born here in Cordova. That's his hometown. Jews live in places like Toledo, you have here, Barcelona, which is further north, not on the map, Girona, different Jewish communities in Spain, and that becomes the primary Jewish community all the way until, you know the date, 1492. Although, it's not so simple, so we'll see when we come to the Rambam. In 1147, I believe, there is the rise of a radical, very violent Islamic sect known as the Almohads. We'll talk about that. And they drive the Jews out of Cordoba, for example, and already relatively early on create terror for the Jews. And we're talking about Spain really in a few different phases, because Spain is fascinating in that during the medieval period, it essentially switches hands. It's the one place that switches hands from Islamic to Christian rulership. And it's a fascinating case study in that regard. And this is an early part of that. Essentially, from around 950 to 1150, we have what we call the Golden Age of Spain. And this is a time of relative fraternity between the Jews and particularly the higher class members of Islamic society. Jews are poets, philosophers, mathematicians, astronomers, and just thinkers really that are extremely broad-minded, are interwoven to a certain degree with their Islamic counterparts. There are famous Islamic philosophers who become extremely influential at this time on the Rambam, earlier on Sadi going to a lesser degree, and there is a real sense of fraternity. We have figures like Rav Shmuel HaNagid, who is a poet and a statesman, personalities along those lines. The Ibn Ezra family comes from this kind of culture, although again they're on the later end. And this is a relatively peaceful time for medieval Jewish history, as we'll see. It's hard to teach medieval Jewish history without everything being about, anti-Semitism and pogrom, earlier versions of pogroms and blood libels and so on. That's a major part, but now we've sort of moved to a wider lens, and certainly this is a big part of that, and this is it's easier to talk about the positive aspects, especially during the Golden Age of Spain. The Almohad rise in 1147 really puts an end to that, so the Rambam is growing up at the very, very end of that culture, give you a sense of the Rambam's own life and the tumultuousness of his life, and that has profound impact, not just on his biography, but on his thought, on his approach to halakha, and the whole project of the Rambam, which we'll get back to later on. The Sephardic community is again primarily anchored in Spain. You have a little bit later on in England, more after the Spanish expulsion. The solid black here is expulsion from Spain. So some will go to the New World, some will go up to England. That's what there's a Sephardic community in England. Some will go back to France. Others will go to Constantinople. Which is over here in Salonika, which had a Jewish community up until World War II. Some will go to places eventually like Tzfat, which is when Rav Yosef Karo writes his Shulchan Aruch in the 16th century, his family had been exiled some 50 years earlier from from Spain. So that's sort of the overview of the Sephardic Jewish migration patterns, and a quick overview of the Sephardic history of the medieval Jewish period. And then alongside that, you have, of course, the Ashkenazic Jewish community. I'm actually grossly oversimplifying by saying that there were two Jewish communities. That's not true at all. There were other Jewish communities at this time that wouldn't necessarily identify fully as simply Ashkenazic or Sephardic, but these are, of course, the best known and the largest. And the Ashkenazic Jewish community is not the one that's really so much or primarily rooted in Baghdad, and it's not the one that goes through North Africa and Morocco and Tunisia and up into Spain. But it's one that's primarily rooted in France and in Germany. When we talk about Ashkenaz in the medieval period, and now I'm already past the time of the Gaonim, and I'm moving toward really that period of, let's say, again, 1,000 to 1,500, very roughly, that's really this community. As opposed to Spain, I didn't elaborate this earlier, but it's worth mentioning, as opposed to Spain where it did switch hands, Spain is subject to what we call the Reconquista, in which essentially the Christians, it's not all that different from when we think about the Crusades. The Crusades were specifically aimed at reconquering Jerusalem. Although, of course, they had some fun along the way. But the Reconquista is aimed at Spain. And so slowly but surely from north to south, Spain is overtaken by Christians. Slowly but surely, they reconquer it, the Reconquista, from the Muslims. So you can actually look at this as a little bit of a quick sketch, if my internet's working. I think that maybe there are wireless phones in the room. Hold on, one second. I brought it up earlier. Okay, here you go. If you take a look, this is a history. If it works. This is a quick. That's probably not. Thank you. So this is a quick sketch. Why is this giving me so much trouble? And what you're going to see here is... No, this is not working properly. This is really strange. If you see her in a minute, at about the 106 point, you're going to start to see Spain. This starts... This is... I don't know why it's not... So this is the history of the different empires of the Mediterranean. So it's got Sparta, it's got Rome. Here's Rome. And then you're going to see Christianity in just about 15 seconds or so. And just take a look at Spain. And it'll give you, again, it's an oversimplification, but it'll give you just a sense of what happens to Spain over the course of medieval Jewish history. I'm trying and it's not going. Here I am. It's really, really strange. Okay, this is the rise of Islam now, sorry. This will give you a sense of just how quickly... Here we are, sorry. It'll give you a sense of just how quickly... This is the Arabian Peninsula. The green is going to be the rise and spread of Islam. Okay, so 7th century, look how quickly they conquer.
What's the purple?
The purple is the Franks, which is early version of what I call Germany.
Interesting.
Okay, and so it's just the speed with which they reconquer. And this is Spain. So 940, they're already starting to push down. And over the course of the early to mid-medieval period, what we, for our purposes, in 1500, you'll see just how dramatic that that process is. So that's really the story of the Jewish community of Spain, which essentially is switching hands. We have this earlier period where it's under Islamic rule, which had swiftly, dramatically overtaken much more than the Arabian Peninsula, but much of Europe, overwhelmingly, it then switches hands and put the Christians push down slowly but surely, and that's going to have dramatic ramifications for and mostly negative, frankly, for the Jewish experience. And it wasn't just 1492. It was throughout, and we're going to be seeing that. In contrast to Spain, the Ashkenazic Jewish community did not have, was not switching hands. It was under Christian and Muslim rule. What's the question? The Ashkenazic Jewish community, is that Christian or Muslim rule? Okay, very much Christian rule. Okay? Yeah. Yeah? Okay? And we're talking about in places like France and in places like Frankfurt, Munich. There was no such thing as Germany at that time. It was a series of different kingdoms. Germany is the modern state. It wasn't called Germany back in the day. But in what we call Germany nowadays, it was a series of different kingdoms. Aragon and so on and so forth. And in London, England, York as well, different places there. Right. This is a devastatingly difficult time in terms of Christian-Jewish relations overall. Modern historians have found some silver linings, but overall, it's pretty difficult. Whether it's the bubonic plague of 1350, whether it's the blood libels, which I think the first recorded case is 1144, whether it's mobs that are attacking Jews, is a famous case in York, in England, which is a blood libel followed by in Shabbat HaGadol, they surround the Jewish community as a mob in a citadel right before Pesach, all sorts of different kinds of stories. And of course, the First Crusade in 1096, we're going to be looking at how it impacted in particular the German Jewish community. And so this becomes a community that on the one hand has tremendous scholarship, is less open-minded, because again, they don't have the interactions, they don't have positive interactions with broad-minded neighbors. This is sort of the medieval polar opposite of the Golden Age of Spain. This is a community that needs to shelter itself. This is a community that sees their Gentile neighbors as evil and pernicious and as hateful and as barbarous. That's what it means to be a Gentile for them. And it's kind of hard to disagree for that community. And it's sort of a mix. And so therefore, in large measure, they focus more on just Gemara or an interpretation of text. They're not as sort of scientific. They don't study secular studies. Spanish Jewish community is much more of a Torah Mada culture than the Ashkenazic Jewish community. Overall, the rise of philosophy takes place in Islam. That takes place in Spain in that earlier period. And in Ashkenaz, the notion of philosophy is a much softer concept. It's much less studied. And where there are biblical commentaries, it's often with a tinge of Jewish-Christian polemic. Mm. Right? So if the Christians interpret Lo Yasur Shiva, Lo Yasur Shemit Mihidam Chokik Migram, right? Ad Ki Avo Shiloh, right? Ad Ki Avo Shiloh, they understand as a reference to the coming of Jesus, of the Messiah. So then how do we understand that pasuk, right? Or if they talk about the Brit Chadasha, the New Covenant, how do we push back and offer our own interpretation? So that's very much the medieval experience of Ashkenazic Jews, Rashi, the Bali and Tosfot, some of the intellectual giants of Jewish history, but they are in dire straits. It's a very difficult time. And that's essentially what we have. Every single kingdom pretty much kicked the Jews out at some point, expelled the Jews within the course of the Ashkenazic medieval experience. The one exception to the rule of the kingdom that kicked Jews out once is France, which did so three times. Which does mean that they accepted us back in. Two times. So depending on who the ruler was. So there's a lot of back and forth. What's interesting also is in the Ashkenazic keynote, there are many references to a lot of these stories. Martyrdom Chronicles about the Crusades. You might be familiar. Is anyone familiar with the Martyrdom Chronicles talking about? There's a whole literature around Jews who give their lives up or take their own lives, which is extremely distressing. It's complicated on so many obvious levels, including halachically as well. notion of suicide in order to avoid being killed by a Christian mob. And these are the kinds of things that happen. There's a whole literature that sort of is developed around these sort of these martyrologies, descriptions of sort of paeans to people who were willing to give their lives during the Crusades at various points in the Ashkenazic medieval Jewish experience, so that in the earlier parts of the Spanish Jewish experience, you have Jews who have a real sense of fraternity with their Muslim neighbors and are engaging in all sorts of kinds of dialogue, and there's a flow, there's a back and forth, there's a conversation. When you move to the Christian medieval experience, in particular Spanish and the later Spanish period, and then throughout the Ashkenazic experience, it's just much more cloistered. That option was not available to the Jewish community. We become moneylenders, and we become all the associations that go along with it, all the stereotypes, and they develop, many of them, at this time. So it wasn't fun, and yet there's a certain richness, and there's a certain depth, the brilliance of people like Rashi and the Baal HaTosfot and some of the later Ashkenazic German and French thinkers. There's some really, really substantial output despite all of that, and some really complicated and really fascinating kinds of the notion of self-histories and sort of the autobiographical self-perception of a tormented community and what that looks like becomes a really prominent part of how we look at this this period of Jewish history. So that's going to be a little bit dour, but it's absolutely intriguing. And those are the two primary Jewish communities. Again, Jews are expelled, and of course from there they start to go to. All right, they start to go to Central and ultimately Eastern Europe, so that when we move from what we call the period of the Rishon to the period of the Achronim, the Ashkenazic, the Sephardic community goes to all the places that we had mentioned earlier. The Ashkenazic community starts to migrate to places like you have over here, right? You have, right, Breslau and Prague, okay? We think about the Maharal, who was living in the 1600s in Prague, and then eventually over further over, Lviv and Kiev and Krakow and Lublin and Warsaw and Minsk and Pinsk and all these different kinds of places that we think of when we think about the modern Jewish community, that up until the time of World War II, this is really the remnant of the Ashkenazic Jewish communities that were expelled one after another in no particular order. We slowly but surely make our way over. So even all the anti-Semitism that we face in places like the Ukraine and in Poland and so on and so forth, there's a long experience of that. And the Ashkenazic Jewish community in particular has a very deep sense of its own problematic relationship with the remaining Christian culture. There's really no question about it. That's why some of the events that took place after World War II with Nostra Aetate and the church reconsidering all of its positions about the deicide and about the responsibilities of the Jews and the relationship with Jews is such a shocking turnaround, because it was 2,000 years of just, you know, on and off a little bit, but for the most part, it's a little bit simplified, but it's true for the most part. It was absolutely devastating overall. Again, exceptions. It's complicated. I don't mean to say it's all one and the same. It's much more subtle than that. But overall, the lived experience and certainly the remembered experience of the Jewish community was a lot of those things as they started to migrate into Central and Eastern Europe. Now, most overviews of medieval Jewish history end there. The problem is that that's pretty insulting to people like, I don't know, Italian Jews. Don't we exist? Are those the only Jewish communities that exist on the face of the planet? There are some really intriguing parts of the medieval Jewish community that are often overlooked, and I think we'd be irresponsible if we didn't at least give some attention to them a little bit, I guess, much later on in the year. But places like Rome and Venice had vibrant Jewish communities with their own traditions. And interestingly enough, despite being sort of closer to the seat of the Christian Empire, very often these Jewish communities experienced more positive experiences, somewhat ironically, than some of their Ashkenazic or Spanish later on neighbors. And so Lom is really interesting because you have Jews who are engaged in that literary culture for much longer than the Spanish Jewish community. Why that is it's fascinating, right? It's almost like you have to take more responsibility when it's, you know, it's right in your backyard. I don't know. It's something to think about. I'm not sure. But that Jewish community develops. It's you might call it a less, and this is, again, just a word, a less... in the sense of observance, maybe it's a less observant community than certainly some of the Ashkenazic counterparts, although you might say the same about certain parts of the Spanish community. Some things that sometimes go along with being embedded in the wider culture, the influence works in all sorts of different ways. So the Roman Jewish community, there's an author that I remember learning about in college and in a secular course with a secular at YU, but it was a secular professor who really didn't know very much about Judaism at all, but he's teaching Yeshiva University. So he taught us Emmanuel of Rome, who was, I think, a 12th century, or maybe 13th, early 13th century Jewish author living in Rome who mimics Dante's style. And he writes very beautifully. He's maybe second rate. He's not Dante, but he kind of borrows. Not even close. But he borrows from that style, and he's writing in verse and in meter and so on and so forth. You have these kinds of individuals who are living in places like Rome throughout this period of time. So there are some segments of the community that sometimes are overlooked, and the Italian Jewish community develops its own set of customs, and they have a completely different kind of way of doing things, and that's one example. Any other examples that come to mind of Jewish communities that don't quite fit? We kind of did one last year, at the end of the year, for those who are here. There are communities that we call Sephardic, but they really have their own traditions and experience. And it's many a Sephardic Jew would be offended to just... What?
Yemen.
Yeah, absolutely. Think about the Yemenite Jewish community as an example. It's right? Just kind of, you just call them Sephardim, right? If you tell it to a Tamani Jew, right? Okay, okay. You come out about as bruised as my computer is right now. It's very interesting. They had their own, and they're certainly in an Islamic society, but it's back and forth, but it doesn't switch hands it doesn't go over to Christian rule. And they have their own set of practices and traditions that develop, but until much later on with merchants and ships that start bringing over things from places like Tzfat and Constantinople that bring the Kabbalistic, the whole Kabbalistic piece. It was an isolated Jewish community. The Rambam writes a famous letter to them, Igaret Zeman, in order to give them strength and to sort of be mechazik the community. They're very much an isolated Jewish community for the majority of the period that we're talking about, and they develop their own approaches to Jewish custom and to studying the Gemara. They don't learn Rashi and Tosfot and the Rif and Rabbi Yochanan, although we mentioned earlier, and they have their own way of doing things, and very much based on the Rambam. They were isolated, and the Rambam became their hero, and so he becomes sort of the central text for that. So whether it's, I think we mentioned this, whether it's bowing until this day, there are some many Jews that do this, so whether it's bowing for Tachna, literally prostrating themselves as opposed to putting their heads down, which I mentioned this morning to the kids. So there are segments of the Jewish community. Even England is somewhat isolated, if you think about it. It's not quite the same culture as the general Ashkenazic community, and so it develops its own rites and its own customs. So there are some outliers that I think are important to mention as well. I just want to then share with you two more maps. Over here, this one we'll do very quickly. It's a little bit smaller. But this just gives you a sense on the Ashkenazic side of things of the migration to Central and then ultimately Eastern Europe. You have Jews coming from places like Germany. And again, they're depending on which state you are in Germany, they're expelled at a different time, or which kingdom. So you have Jews going to places like Krakow and to Lemberg, to Lublin, to Lodz, right, and all to Kovna, right, to Vilnius, to Vilna, to Grodno, to Bialystok. I mean, these are places that we've heard of. And then you have the Crimean Jews, again, often overlooked. You have Jews going to Lithuania and then coming out down back here. So this is just to give a sense. But you see where we're going. We're all going to the same direction, to Central and Eastern Europe. And this is really, if we were doing early modern Jewish history, this would be our Ashkenazic focus at this time period. So that's going to be the piece that we're not going to be focusing as much on. But again, it's places like Prague, where the Maharal is about, you know, these kinds of communities in Central and Eastern Europe. That becomes the next stage in the Ashkenazic community. Again, as opposed to the Sephardic community, where they're either going west to, the earliest ones are going west to the Americas. Again, they're coming down here to Constantinople. They're going to Israel and some going back up to France, right? Or back up to England, some going to Amsterdam. You know, so those are some of the places where, right, the Ashkenazi, where the Sephardic Jews are going. In fact, they have that little map, so it's harder to see, so I won't do it as much. But you have your migrations of the Spanish Jews. You can just start to see that they are going in a very different direction overall. There are some that are going here, but really they're going to completely different locations overall than the Ashkenazic Jewish communities in the aftermath of the expulsion of 1492. And again, in the Sephardic experience, it's not a series of expulsions, but it's just one large expulsion that really abruptly concludes the Sephardic and the experience in Spain for all intents and purposes. I'll give you a sense. One other place I didn't mention that also, well, I guess I mentioned a little bit, but just to widen it, it's Italy in a larger sense. And so I mentioned Rome, but it's also Naples and Florence a little bit. These are places, the Renaissance, there are Jews around Florence during the Renaissance period. Again, Italy kind of, you know, it's off on its own. It's right, kind of like England is off on its own. And so that becomes sort of a separate, isolated Jewish experience. Okay. So that's sort of our overview. What I'd like to do next time, I'm going to stop here, what we're going to do next time is essentially to jump into the period of the Gaonim, and we're going to do some, do a little bit of reading also, it should be fun. We're going to look at a much later, I'll do some overview, but also look specifically at an installation of an exilarch. It's a great piece, a little bit later on, it's a 12th century text. But what was the pomp and circumstance? What was the ceremony like when the exilarch, when the Reish Galuta was appointed? In Islamic context, with the Jewish community, when there were these religious leaders of Sura and Kapadita, the rabbis, what was that like? What was the image? What happened? What was sort of that ceremony all about? And we're going to use that as sort of a way of beginning to sort of get a sense for the texture, sort of the feel for the Jewish experience time of the Gaonim. We'll then look at some specific personalities of Gaonim, and we'll spend some time on Rav Saadia Gaon in particular. So that's where we're going next, and focus on the Gaonim, and then we're going to trace the Gaonim into northern Africa, and then we'll look at the Spanish Jewish experience. So we're going to sort of be tracing that community all the way there, and then after, that'll take us plenty of time, and then we'll come back separately to the Ashkenazic experience, and then we're going to go from there. Okay?
Thank you.
I appreciate your bearing with us during our technological difficulties, and I appreciate it.